States and maybe once in a lifetime. I just recently came back from the Dominican and it was incredible. Like, we saw genodermatoses walking in the door every second. The patients are so happy. They're traveling from 2:30 in the morning to get on a bus just to come see this institute. They sit there for 6 hours and then they wait and they're very happy and they smile when they leave. They get their medications and it's phenomenal because they use a huge compounding institute. So the medications that they make are very specific that they can get for them to accommodate their needs as far as how much it's going to cost them. We do understand that medications, even biologics today, are very expensive. They do have access to these, but they try to do everything they can to make it very affordable for these patients. I highly recommend if you do have any time even to spend a week over there, you would see more than you could ever imagine as far as any kind of conditions and diseases. Oh yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, did you go on the Vitaes when you were there?
You know, I didn't have the opportunity to do
I
that.
I did that two times, and like you said, people were lined up in the hot sun just waiting to get in to see us.
It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. And, you know, I spent in medical school, I went there and spent time just doing general medicine at first. So we did a lot of different things as far as diagnosing, but my time spent in the Dominican at the Institute, it's just very worthwhile even in your retirement years if you have time to go there. Very gratifying, and you see so many things. So we'll get started with the presentation. Why this is really exciting is tropical dermatology is really going to be something you really need to know about with your patients. Different rashes that are going to present can be very confusing to people, and as far as primary care is concerned, they may try to initially treat it. So you may actually be seeing the secondary manifestations of the rash. So it may be already partially treated, it could be with antibiotics, and it may be you might lose the actual presentation of some of the rash, but they may describe that to you and be sent further, and maybe you can see some kind of rheumatologic aspects to it. So the biggest thing that I kind of think about is when we think about tropical dermatology, our patients are going raw. They're going on exciting trips. A lot of the time we kind of forget about that. A lot of people are coming to the United States. And in fact, pretty soon, tropical areas in the United States, in 2025, about 60% of children are going to be in the tropical areas. So we think about patients that are coming over here for college, for education, and just coming to the United States to stay here permanently with their family. There's lots of things that are changing. Initially, when we think about tropical dermatology, we think about sunburns. We think about people, like, what do you identify? So the goal of my lecture today is to make you look at a sunburn and then look at something that seems pretty kind of rare. You may never see it just in textbooks. Recognize it as easy as you could as a sunburn. So we'll kind of go through this intermittently. I've kind of put some like really horrible sunburns throughout. So the first thing we'll do is we'll start with just a YouTube video that kind of reiterates what we were talking about here.
One grain of rice?
Yes, that's what I said, one rice.
Oh my god.
Oh, oh. Wow, you got some sun.
You noticed. I can't wait until this glow turns into a beautiful golden tan. I think it's a little burnt. It's all part of my process. I burn myself really good at the end of summer, so it turns into a tan that lasts all winter.
Okay, I don't think that's how it works.
Yeah.
Guys, I do this every year. I think I know how my body works.
Yeah! Whoa!
No! I thought you were burned before, but your body is so much worse.
Yeah, you look like the Canadian flag, just red and white.
Thank you. It's so nice to see where you started from, you know?
No, you're like really burned. Does that not hurt?
Yes, that's how I know it's working. Okay, will you chill on my back?
Okay.
Thank you.
Oh god, I'm starting to peel. That's the next step.
I can't finish. You have to do the rest.
You're molting.
You guys are just jealous. You're going to be rusty, crusty, jelly in October, and I'm going to be a golden goddess.
Oh, I think I got some in my mouth.
Yes, it's spreading.
It looks like you have golf balls in your face.
Ooh, goody. Popping blisters is my favorite part.
Oh.
Once these blisters heal, I'm going to have the sexiest tan.
Oh, oh god, no. Stop popping.
I think you need medical attention.
Oh, come on. I'm supposed to trust the two most pale people in the office.
It's getting worse.
Thank you.
Oh, no.
It has to get worse before it gets better.
You look like Jeff Goldblum in The Fly.
Oh, goody. That means it's time to go on the roof and get a top coat.
No.
This is going to be the sickest tan ever. Hi, I'm Cynthia from College Humor. Click here to subscribe. Click here for more fun stuff. And now for a wipe breakdown. Star wipe.
So So, just like we said, a lot of people think about these are people that are vacationing. Maybe they're going abroad for any kind of, like, extra help for patients and volunteerism. But a lot of the time you may see the common effects of them being abroad is sunburn. So we'll kind of go through different things that are very important for you to recognize, because a lot of the tropical diseases that we do have, a lot of these are actually going to be very scary for patients. And in fact, 10% of the tropical diseases that we'll see, if we can identify it early, patients are going to be hospitalized and you can save someone's life by it. So looking at the tropics, kind of trying to understand exactly what we're talking about when we think about the tropics. So we always kind of think about the tropics as being, you know, Caribbean or going on cruises, things like that. But some of the things we forget about is that southern China is actually included within the tropics. Indonesia, New Guinea, Brazil, Bolivia, and Nigeria. So these patients are kind of all over in the spectrum of this area. In fact, the tropics are increasing. When we think about tropics, we think about tropic temperate as well, or temperature and things. So they kind of get grouped in some kind of subcategory, but the main thing is understanding what's going to be manifesting there as far as zoonotic diseases and what's going to be infecting our patients when we travel to these exotic places. So why do you want to pay attention to this today? So most importantly, when we think about this, that households are actually traveling quite a bit. We think about people that maybe they're not traveling because they can't afford it, but in fact, households making greater than 20% per annual year, 90% of those households are going to be actually starting international travel. Amongst that, by 2025, 50% of households are going to be affording these vacations, and one out of those eight that are below the 20,000 per year are actually still going to go ahead and travel abroad, whether it be that they're using any other kind of financial income, or if they're visiting their family, when we think about people that are coming from these different locations. So in the tropics, they're home to about 4 of every 10 people that are alive today. So when you think about that, that's quite a bit that you'd kind of recognize. And I, when I was preparing this presentation, didn't realize that was how much it was involved. In the United States, we have projected on the right 2015. This is where the most of our people that are living in the United States are traveling exotically. So mainly we think about Mexico, and that kind of makes sense as far as any kind of vacations and things. Bahamas, Jamaica, China, and India are also included in this. And it's going to get a lot more as far as spanning and traveling, although we do have some kind of social politics that are maybe delineating or stopping that progression of travel. So moving on to the next slide. So facts, so kind of things that you want to think about with rashes. Now you guys are the experts for this, and recognizing this is important. You're going to get a lot of referrals by things that are really very confusing by primary care physicians. So amongst everything, when you think about your general patient that presents, you're still going to use your same clinical skills. So that's going to be you're looking at the patient, you're asking them for systemic symptoms that are involved, and then you're considering a biopsy if there is anything that's continuously presenting. Rashes are common, and they're really going to be the most common complaint that we see amongst travelers, especially if we think about travel clinics. When patients represent, even if it's abroad or if it's here in the United States, 20% of these things are going to be presenting with rashes. Up to 10% of the travel-related skin disorders are going to be hospitalized, and that means they're very detrimental for you guys to recognize some of these different conditions. And most of the dermatologic problems are diagnosed clinically by clinical presentation, so that fits into all of your clinical diagnostic skills that you guys have been practicing for so long. Really making sure that you think about any kind of arthralgias, fevers, and really getting a very, very good prior history for these patients. They're going to forget. They're going to maybe say, oh, I forgot I had a fever, I forgot this, but you really want to know. They may think that it was associated with vaccinations or something, or even just something else that was incidental their family had, but you want to investigate that a little bit more when they complain about these things. So looking at a broad overview, we're going to cover, there's quite a bit when we think about tropical dermatology, and in fact, I talked to one of the experts in tropical dermatology at the American Academy of Dermatology meeting. And he said that he's like one of the best books they have out there, and he said it's pathetic. Like he hates it. He said there's a very, very big need for an update in tropical dermatology as far as it goes for literature. There is a lot of reviews, and we think with the emergence of Zika and things that people are very concerned about recently, that there would be something more more concrete, I guess, in that sense, or having a textbook that's available for people. But looking at the leading expert and talking with them for tropical dermatology, he is not satisfied with this book at all. And in fact, he's actually bringing together more of a manual. His initial edition was focused on Army. So we think about that being a lot of our broad category of people that are traveling across these places and coming into contact with this, as well as getting vaccinations to prevent any kind of care. He's now trying to focus that more on the patients that are actually not in the Army, that they're actually traveling and things like that. So in fact, there's lots of things to break it down when we talk about tropical dermatology. We can discuss viral aspects to opposite bacterial and other conditions that we might see with patients that we may not necessarily see as commonly in the States. Initially, when we talk about some of the viral aspects, I'll list some of the things that are important and some things we may not have time to touch upon, but there are different things that you want to recognize. So kind of go through this briefly, and then I will be sending out probably my PowerPoint to you guys. If there's a broad email, I can send it to you with more of the updated information on it eventually later. I have to edit a couple things to make sure that it's all copyrighted and available. So when we think about this, we think about viruses. So tropical viruses, this is something that you really think about when you're learning in school and any kind of transmission of zoonotic diseases. So kind of start here. So recognizing viral infections. So when you think about a patient and they come in and you say, okay, oh, have they been bitten by something? Is this something that's external, a contact dermatitis? What's your thinking? We always kind of think about your breakfast, lunch, and dinner presentation. So looking at something and you see kind of in this description here with the bologna is a nice clinical quote or codochrome for us is breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They tend to be these three, either macules if you see them at different time frames versus papules and nodules. They may be excoriated and changing, but they tend to be really grouped in different areas. So picking up on that presentation that they're actually pretty much grouped in little pockets, that can be helpful as well. Also taking into account, is this something that your patient can excoriate? Is it in a location in their back that they can't reach, but there's actually that distribution? Is it on their legs? Were they traveling? You know, did they come into contact with ticks? And in fact, thinking about anything like Lyme's disease and stuff, that's on the rise. That's huge, huge, huge right now. And I just talked to a veterinarian yesterday. She has seen a multitude of pets that are coming in with three ticks on them. She said, I think that the human population doesn't understand that this is going to be a very big epidemic as far as things in the United States. So recognizing things that are associated with Lyme's disease is going to be important internally here as well as when your patients go abroad. So different things such as really looking at the patient and saying, did they cause this? Is it something external or range brushing gets them versus this grouping of your breakfast, lunch, and dinner on your patients clinically? So there are lots of viral infections that we can think about when we think about tropical dermatology. We have viral hemorrhagic fevers, dengue fever, West Nile, which used to be a really, really big thing. We think back even 5-10 years ago. Chikungunya fever, which seemed to be more on the emergence that we've seen in the last few years, as well as monkeypox and Zika, which Zika seems to be covering the news quite frequently over the last 3 years. These things you may think you're never going to see, but actually one of my colleagues that was training in at Botsford, she had a patient that came in. She loved doing abroad volunteer dermatology. Patient walked in and straight out of bologna, like a clinical codochrome, multiple little pox areas, multiple skin colored papules in this patient. And the mother was like, I have no idea what's going on with my child. They went abroad, monkeypox. And you don't think you're actually going to have this walk into you and into your office at all. It happened. She said that she's actually seen two, surprisingly, in her residency training, which is crazy to me because I don't know if I've ever see one in my entire career. They say not to chase to zebras, but don't forget about the zebras. That's one of the big things you want to think about. If it fits, you don't want to not rule it out if you need to do any kind of testing. Again, though, you don't want to spend too much money, you know, as far as working something up that really isn't feasible for a patient if they haven't been exposed in that area. So briefly with viral infections, the main thing you're thinking about when you think about viral infections are how are they going to present. They're very non-specific cutaneous eruptions. So we think that they can have some kind of mucosal involvement and hemorrhaging. So make sure you're doing a complete physical exam. Look inside of their mouths. Make sure you're not seeing anything that's going on in that area. Don't forget about, you know, nose. Is there anything else that's going on? As far as the demonstration, we see a petechial presentation. Additionally, they have some kind of mild systemic diseases. So they may have some kind of fevers, arthralgias. The time frame is very important. So really getting down, like, do they have it 3 days ago? Did they have a fever that presented with that? And that may help you clinically delineate which disease this is as far as viral infections go, especially gathering the history as to where they travel. So these are some of the things that we think about with viral hemorrhagic fevers. This includes Ebola, Marburg, Lassa, Hantavirus, yellow fever, Rift Valley fever, and other hemorrhagic fevers. Focusing on different things such as the transmission. Looking at yellow fever, we think about the Aedes aegyptia mosquito. And we think about this with infecting tissue. And I know that probably forever ago back in your biology class, some things you looked at the life cycle and transmission of these kind of organisms. Thinking about whether this is coming from the sand versus traveling, you know, from human to human versus from pet to pet. Didn't want to bore you guys with that today because those are all things that you can look up. Mainly just focusing on what these clinical presentations are going to be so you can recognize it in the mm-hmm. your textbooks. So a lot of the viral hemorrhagic fevers are going to be supportive care. So really, even if you don't exactly recognize what this is initially with presentations and you think about the macules, the purpura, the hemorrhagic conditions within their bowel, it's probably going to be okay for some of these. The one thing is that supportive care is going to help. If they're not getting better, obviously you want to send them to the hospital pretty quickly, especially if their symptoms are worsening, including if you did a basic like blood panel and their liver enzymes have elevated or anything along those lines. So always making sure you're keeping a close eye on these patients if anything might have some kind of clinical crashing that could be ahead. So my first horrible sunburn. Dengue fever, so just a couple things on the transmissions. This could be high yield for any kind of boards or representation of these, but transmitted by the Aedes mosquito. Typically, this is asymptomatic and life-threatening. It is an asymptomatic infection to life-threatening. So this is a really broad spectrum when it comes to dengue fever. We can see fevers and headaches with these patients, as well as retroorbital pain. So that might be one of the things that's like a buzzword for you as far as that goes. Really, really severe retroorbital pain. Severe joint pain, like what I call breakbone fever. For anything, it's morbilliform rash. So we use the term morbilliform. We don't usually use that word, really. You see someone that uses that term, and you see that a lot more in primary care versus in our specialty because we're used to dermatology. So morbilliform, we're thinking these are macules and papules that are coalescing. And there's few conditions that we actually can actually call morbilliform eruptions. Dengue fever is one. This is in a scarlatina form of exanthem as well, and there can be some islands of sparing in 50% of these patients that are presenting. They also can have gingival bleeding as well as TKA. Treatment for this is supportive care, so just making sure that they have all of that is very important. So West Nile virus, I know that you guys have probably heard a lot about this probably 5 or 10 years ago. This is kind of a big issue when we're talking about cruise ships and traveling. It's transmitted by the Helix mosquito. This, very similar to most of our viral infections, is going to present with fever and headaches. Encephalitis, we do have some pretty potential causes, more systemic symptoms. The myalgias, the pain in the muscle is a pretty prominent thing that we see with this condition, but it also presents with eye pain. So when you think about dengue, we talked about the retroorbital pain in that area, as well as here we get eye pain. The exanthem actually only shows up in 25% of your patients that are presenting. So you may never see this at all, but in 25% of the patients you may have a rash that's presenting with it. So collecting any kind of different symptoms, including the nausea, vomiting, and the really, really bad myalgias, could be something you can think about. They may complain of these fevers and headaches, which are continual. So really treating that if it doesn't go away and sending them to the hospital. Chikungunya fever. It's probably my favorite word to say. We had a couple at St. Joe's that had come through, and Dr. Gaffieri, one of our derm path attendings, also had a colleague that sent her information for it. So we've been kind of on high alert in our residency, but there may be chikungunya at some point, but it's basically just because we like to say the word. So we think about monkeypox virus, and this is transmitted by contact with infected body fluids. We present with flu-like symptoms and vesicles and pustules that are going to rust. Horrible sunburn. That was just kind of a review of some things. When I send out the information, you guys will have more of a detailed examination as what you're going to see with fevers. There's going to be a little bit more photos. The concern was a little bit of the copyright thing, so I'm just waiting to get back some permission before I can send it out to you. So it'll have a lot more as to what you can recognize and a little bit more organization for you. So Zika as well is transmitted by the Aedes mosquito. Zika has been a big concern, and before I traveled to the Dominican Republic in our group last year, they definitely had a lot of talking with us as far as things. Now you understand that what the CDC has put out is what, as far as we know, as far as testing further. The big thing is with females that if you are pregnant, you do not want to be infected by Zika. It's hard to say because we're seeing things in Miami that are presenting with Zika. So then, you know, the big thing is obviously your baby. We're thinking about microcephaly and things that can present with this as well. The one thing is that within the sperm, this can also be affected. So they've tested the sperm out to about 6 months, and they say that that's probably about enough time. So if you're not planning on having children, you can educate your patients on this, that they say roughly after leaving a tropical environment about 6 months, if you were to be infected, that it's okay to have children. I'm not completely convinced as to whether or not they've actually done sperm testing beyond the 6 months. They haven't released enough information. So, I mean, you kind of want to educate your patients that this is your decision. Obviously, be careful with things. There is testing that can be done. So if you think that you're coming back with any kind of clinical symptoms of feeling like you've had fevers or any kind of whites or things that while you're in a tropical environment, there can be blood and laboratory stuff that's sent to the CDC. It's fairly pricey, but right now I'm not sure exactly how they're reimbursing or if they're just collecting this for data. Additionally, anyone that's also concerned about rashes and things, they'll work up another panel that might correlate a little bit with Zika presentation or tropical disease. So everything's fairly new as far as what we're doing and how we're managing these patients. I think education as far as the travel clinics go and preventing, making sure that you're wearing your preventative gear as far as soaking your things in permethrin, and making sure they're using appropriate coverage at night. So that's one of the things that tends to be kind of feared, but as everything travels with the mosquitoes, it's just a matter of time before we get into the United States kind of thing. So just kind of really being very cognizant and wearing any kind of protection is very important. So the World Health Organization did name Zika global health threat, and that was placed in 2016. The big thing again was with this uterine infection that can cause microcephaly. The exanthem can occur with a morbid rash as well with macular. There can be conjunctivitis as well as headaches that are correlated with this. The problem is the fever is really not that prominent, so people may just kind of like wave it off, like, oh, this is really no big deal. They may never even recognize that they were infected with Zika. For our hope is that, you know, that it's not replicating in the sperm beyond the 6 months. And for our females, they say really only 2 to 3 months that you're not really that concerned about, then you can actually conceive after. The verdict's still out on everything for as far as the testing goes, but I'm sure that we'll be being very updated pretty soon with everything. So moving on, tropical dermatology to bacterial infections. Bacterial infections, we have quite a bit. I apologize, I'm on call as well. So as far as bacterial infections go, there is quite a bit of things that we can see. We think about a slant differential, and I'm not sure if you guys have covered this, you know, in most of your clinics and things, but we see a lymphocutaneous spread, and that basically means we follow the lymphatics that are presenting, and we can see the distribution of the cutaneous lesions that are going to go like along the arm. That's kind of our tip off. So the slant is kind of our acronym for thinking about the lymphocutaneous spread. We can think about sporotrichosis, tularemia, or we can think about atypicals, nocardia, lots of things, and I'll summarize this kind of in the email that I'll be sending you guys as well. Those are some things I'm actually not going to touch upon today because they're kind of covered a lot better in our textbooks. Understanding, you know, the patient presenting with this and you're seeing an lymphocutaneous spread, they may send you down to look into that chapter further in Bologna. We're going to cover just a couple other bacterial infections that's a little more prevalent for discussion. So like we said, there are tons of bacterial infections that can be infecting in tropical diseases, and so many that they present somewhat similarly for some of the things, so sometimes it's hard to distinguish these amongst all the others. So we're just going to cover a couple of them that seem to be fairly important to make sure you recognize. So Mycobacterium tuberculosis. So when we think about this as being the cutaneous presentation of tuberculosis, think about inoculation from an exogenous source, and primarily that's going to be from inoculation of tuberculosis. Endogenous cutaneous spread is seen, and we see this, it can present in multiple cutaneous presentations, including a scleroderma, which we'll show on the next slide. There's hematogenous spread that also can be occurring with miliary TB as well as the vis vulgaris presentation. We also can see erythema in rotum is another one that can be presenting for cutaneously for these patients. It's beginning to increase worldwide. In fact, 30 to 60% in adults in affected developing countries tend to be affected throughout their lifetime with multiple cutaneous forms. As you can see here, this is scleroderma. This is your tuberculosis involved in the skin. The direct extension of the underlying lymphadenitis from tuberculosis. So big things that I thought about a lot when I was in the Dominican Republic was leprosy. So leprosy is actually still common, and we do see this in the United States. We really thought we had it a lot under control, but with the whole traveling and everything, things do get spread. Patients can live a lifetime in a household with someone who has full-fledged Hansen's disease, and they actually may never get it, but their risk is increased. It's a chronic disease that's caused by M. leprae, and peripheral nerve sensation is one of the biggest things that we notice with these patients. So not only if you think about a diabetic patients and things, you would definitely be checking in the peripheral nerve and sensory loss in the skin. Upper airway and mucosal involvement can also be affected as well. So like I said, leprosy is not something that is of the past times or biblical times. It's still present, and especially in the Dominican Republic. There are multiple leper colonies that you can go to in these places, and even in India as well as the United States, we used to have one that still may have a little bit activity there. Incubation period for transmission of leprosy is around 3 months to 40 years. So this presentation can really occur at any time, and you may have come across it, and the patient would never know when they did come across it or where they were infected. Treatment, we think about rifampin, dapsone, and clofazimine. Those are some things that you kind of reference once you have maybe established a diagnosis or have a very astute clinical suspicion for this within a patient. So like we said, that leprosy can be seen in 2000 at multiple locations as areas of high incidences as well as low incidences, but it's still in these areas that are prominent. So with multiple presentations of leprosy, we see a spectrum. When we think about leprosy, it's basically how is your body reacting. Initially, you're going to have a very reactive period because you're going to have a lot of the infection that's involved. Your body is able to react, and then eventually goes down this kind of line as we think about the spectrum of leprosy. They may be full-fledged and more so infected at that point, but their body loses their ability to fight with that. These are multiple clinical presentations that are affecting in leprosy. We see sensory all the way in this upper hand corner, all the way to autoamputation that occurs with leprosy. Motor involvement is a big thing, and when we do testing according to the World Health Organization, you're doing a pinprick sensitivity testing as well as a cotton swab sensitivity testing. So we're looking at a different diffuse of their nerve impingement and how that is being affected. This is causing mycobacterium leprae. In the bottom corner, we can see that there's the claw hand deformity that can be presented with leprosy. And we look at the bottom corner of the face over there. Leprosy leprosy and that presentation can also be present in multiple other conditions. So not necessarily if you did see that typical lepra face, that's not necessarily going to mean that's caused by that. There's quite a few, actually, at least 15 different things that can eventually present like that. So things just kind of look up eventually if you did see this clinical condition. So on the corner of one spectrum of a leprosy leprosy are nodule infiltrations that can destroy the underlying structures. We get the saddle nose deformity, which also can be seen in different clinical conditions, and the leonine facies. So that leonine facies, again, can be present in multiple other conditions, not necessarily specific to leprosy. Sensory loss over the distal limbs is one of the initial things that we think about as well for diagnosis. Borderline leprosy, which moves down the spectrum, we see that with numerous lesions that are annular, and we have symmetrical nerve involvement that appears later on throughout this distribution of the process of this condition. And then tuberculoid leprosy. And clinically in presentation, we can see hypopigmented saucer-like shapes. They tend to be single, or maybe even a maximum of 2 to 3 that are going to present cutaneously. The patients will complain of numbness and pain, tingling, and muscle weakness that will be associated, which further progresses, which we see in the line of like autoamputation and things that may show up. Another summary. So other. So there's lots of things that you guys will see and even in our general population that's in the surrounding area, regardless of where you're working in the United States. A lot of these things have to do with poor like health. Are they taking care of themselves? Are they having good environments that they're living with? The big things we think about that were on the rise in New York, especially a while back, was that those are big things that tend to affect all of us because you think about hotel travel. Even in the most expensive hotel rooms that you can still get bed bugs. And then you can take them back to your house and then send them all over, and it's horrible. So we're going to cover quite a few different things with other. Other bed bugs, including scabies, talk about lice, tachyosis, myiasis, as well as cutaneous anthrax. So bed bugs. We think about bed bugs. The main distribution that you want to consider is this bug is very big. So it's not something that you're going to be like, oh gosh, I don't see it, it's not there. They actually can bring it in and you can physically see it, as opposed to lice and things like that. You may see the nymphs of lice, you may see different like things, but for it to be this big, you can recognize it with the kind of blood feeding thing. So they do say that, you know, bed bugs, typically they're night bugs in a sense. They like to stay in warm, like collected places. They can live for a really long time on beds. As far as recognizing that you have a syndrome condition, you need to make sure that you're educating your patients on completely getting rid of everything that they need to get rid of that could be infected with it. As well as, you know, if you're able to treat things in clothing and put that in the hot dryer and really just try to get rid of everything. They're in an apartment complex. You really need to make sure that they tell their apartment complex because they're going to have to get an affirmicator to come in and make sure these bugs are gone. And they fall from the walls. Like, it's disgusting and horrible. So some things that you really just need to make sure that they tell, and they're going to be embarrassed and they're not going to want to say, hey, I've got bed bugs. I need you to check the entire apartment to make sure that they're doing okay and that no one else has it. But our college campus in Michigan State, when I was there, the apartment next door had it, and we just had a lot of people that were there, and they'd gone on spring break, and it was a 24-unit complex, and I'm pretty sure almost everyone ended up moving out of it because they couldn't get rid of all the stuff. So it's very hard. These bugs are very, very, very non-destructive. I mean, they could go through nuclear war and still be okay. So really just educating the patients and making sure that their surroundings, people understand what's going on with that as well. So scabies. So not only do you guys see scabies a lot, I'm sure, thinking about scabies worldwide is a very big problem. When we're in the Dominican Republic, they don't think it's anything. Like, they walk up, they shake their hands, and they're like, ah, scabies, no big deal. And I remember my colleagues, and I just feel like, oh gosh, put the permethrin up and down my body. Like, we were very, pretty, like, impressed that they were okay with it. But that's just one of the things. When you think about your living conditions, and that's what you want to gather for your history, making sure that you recognize clinical presentations for scabies, and I'm sure you guys have seen this today or blown in the face, but understanding the burrows that present. Making sure that anyone that's itching and the household members that are itching, and we had presentations of children and their friend, they stayed over the night and they brought it to the other household. As far as treating patients when you think about scabies, it's kind of like a rough border. If you haven't seen their mom, you haven't seen their dad, they have scabies too, and they can't come in, they're just going to keep reinfecting, they're going to come back, they're going to infect your office again. So technically speaking, sometimes, you know, if you're prescribing medication, you're giving them enough for the person to put the permethrin from the neck down the first night and then repeating it again. If you're giving them a bulk quantity, hopefully their family members are going to be able to use it, but you're wanting to encourage the family members to make sure that they go, because if you put an atopic person with like permethrin all over themselves and they are horribly, you know, painful and itchy afterwards, that would also be your license. You really, really want to make sure you understand the family, make sure you understand the circumstances, but you also don't want your office to get reinfected. So kind of taking that all into with a grain of salt. So itching often is worse at night. That's with a lot of our conditions that we're seeing patients are for. They sit up at night, they don't exactly know what to do, so they itch. So with glaucoma, they'll say we're really, really itchy, and close contacts are also itchy. So ruling out any like conditions for their animals that they have or something that's causing it can be very important as well. Recognizing the web spaces, looking at that and looking at the wrist, as well as the waist and the willy, that's things that you really want to pay attention to. And that's not a joke, because I feel like as being a female provider, a lot of the men don't want to show those areas, and females vice versa for guy practitioners. Making sure that you know that what may be going on, if they say, hey, I'm itching a little bit here, and you say, oh, it's nickel dermatitis because it's something that's right around the belt line, that could really ruin their whole family for a while if you're not going to diagnose it appropriately. So just making sure that you get that full clinical exam and asking, so they may be embarrassed as to what's causing it. So when we think about scabies, we think about Cecropides scabiae. The treatment for this, again, is permethrin. There's other options for patients as well, including lindane, benzoyl, lots of things, malathion. The big thing is understanding, you know, is this being prescribed appropriately? Can we use this? But the big thing we think about is, how advanced is scabies? Are we going to see the crested scabies in these patients, which are going to require a little bit more than just your initial treatment? So when you do your clinical scraping, you lift the look under the microscope, and you can see this little guy. And he's moving, and he's creepy, and you may even see just like the little eggs from his babies. But diagnosing it, there's some satisfaction in it because you know what's causing it. And this is crested scabies. So this is very much so present. Like, we have consults on this all the time in the hospital, and they will be in there and they think it's no big deal. And they finally consult us 2 weeks after they've been in there, and then they have to clean the entire hospital. The grossest thing I think I've ever seen is maggots coming out of someone that looked like crested scabies that we were consulted for. But I mean, it's just, when you think about your patients that are coming in with these thickened scale that's on their feet, you're diagnosing them with tinea and things, but you had I would say, like, shortly into my first year of residency, I realized shaking hands is not always appropriate with people. It's very hard because you want to make sure that you're engaging everyone, you're making them happy, you know, you're welcoming them, you say, hey, I want to work with you. But you also be transferred to the EVs and multiple different things. So really kind of, you know, gathering your presentation when you walk into the room is very important because you're going to cry that night if you touch them and they had a lot of EVs all over them. But it's okay. So clinical management is always important for recognizing those things. So here's a little bit more extensive things. So probably satisfying when you do your scrapings. You may see the scabies, but you also may see the little eggs that are there. The scapula can be there as well. Scabies, when it gets very, very further along, you see all these trackings, and these patients may not come to you until later, and it may look just like an exogenous drug reaction, something that's going on, dermatitis. They really may not give you a really good story at all. They're stitchy. So just really making sure that even if it's progressive and not just in the burrow, you may not even see a burrow. So really check and do a scraping for these patients, because it's not going to be fun if you're not able to diagnose it appropriately. Like, oh, there's that brain. So moving on to another fun topic, lice. Lice, again, is another one of the bane of our existence. And in fact, your dressers are really kind of making a lot of money off of this disease. So the family members, once they realize they have lice, they're really upset because their children cannot go to school. So they come into your office and you diagnose it, and they have nurses that have seen it. They want to do the best they can to get those kids right back in school, but they don't want to get reinfected. So a lot of hairdressers now have like lice things that they can take away and remove, and they're charging like $200, $300 just to do lice removal, and that's, I think, some of the cheaper ends that we have. So it's up to you in kind of recommending different things for patients as far as doing the treatments for lice. Obviously, there's different, you know, shampoos and things we go through when we try to get things out. But when you look at the hair follicle, you want to just make sure that this actually is indeed lice or a nit. Sometimes we can have different concretions that are attached to the hair shaft, so that can be very confusing. And in fact, if you're able to even just pull a hair and look at it under the microscope, that may help you kind of clinically differentiate what we're dealing with. But if they come in and they say, hey, everyone at school has lice, it's pretty easy to kind of go, okay, well, you probably have lice, let's go ahead and we'll treat it. But the same thing as far as scabies goes and bed bugs, this is all very frustrating for people because you have to bag all your stuff up, put it in, you know, I guess in the Dominican they put it all outside, but put it in the dryer and try to take care of things, but it's just so hard. So especially with females, they don't want to cut their hair or things. I think the simplest solution for guys is actually just asking them to shave their heads if they're okay with it. So pubic lice. This is while syphilis is highly on the rise, so make sure that you're really educating your patients for this. We actually were talking about a patient that we saw with syphilis last week in our clinic, and it was secondary syphilis. So we were presenting with cutaneous lesions, and typically we're going to see more of an exudative eruption that's, you know, pretty broad. This patient only had like kind of lamellata, so he only had the presentation on the penile shaft. You know, the funny thing is like he had a sexual encounter that was 6 months prior. Said he swore up and down, he wore condoms and everything. But once we called the CDC, they're running out of penicillin G. So you think about that when you memorize reports, like, what do you treat syphilis with? Penicillin G. That's the most important thing to think about. So penicillin G, we called the CDC because we needed to know how to send and treat this patient. So we had to schedule a separate appointment for our, like, organization in Michigan for him to go to. So the big thing is that even with patients, when you think about syphilis, you want to make sure that you're treating them even if they have an allergy. So they have to be desensitized. Some of the board books, some of the review books are going to say, hey, give them doxycycline, give them something else. But if you can desensitize that patient and treat them, you don't want them to progress to tertiary syphilis, which honestly happens quite frequently. When you think about primary syphilis, they're not going to recognize that initial condition. And then when you think about secondary, they may perchance see that they have an exudative rash, but that only happens about 25% of people. And then to tertiary syphilis, which we had a consult at Beaumont last week, and they had tertiary syphilis, you have to do spinal tap. They're now signing themselves up for IV antibiotics for 3 weeks. So really having a really good cue on things that are what we thought was still in the olden days, it's highly on the rise. So with that, now people are thinking pubic lice are also going to be present because we're having a lot more sexual encounters, decreased amount of condoms and things like that because people forget about it. In like the 90s, they would talk about those things and not that much. So permethrin, you know, you want to make sure that you're really taking care of these things when it comes to pubic lice. Sometimes we have to coat eyelashes in the pubic area, but just recognizing these and what they kind of look like in the pubic area our kind of case report. We had a 21-year-old soldier that returned from military exercise in Guyana. Kind of look at these clinical presentation. We think that he's abroad. What are we going to think about? So big things is what came into contact with this boat. Was he on the sand? Do you think about different species that can be collected in that area? Was it maybe just a contact? Is he a trench foot? What's going on with him? When you look at this clinically, it actually looks like you're seeing more burrows into the skin. The patient complained of progression of painful red spots that turned into papules to nodules and now these black dots. They can be pearl-like with presentation as well. And this was fungiasis, so you're seeing flea presentation or the presentation. So it's not to say that this can't happen in the United States. You have soldiers and things that are going abroad, so you want to kind of think about what that is and even doing biopsies and things, but it's hard to biopsy the foot. So when you evaluate these things, usually we think about the foot with fungiasis, but just to kind of keep a close clinical eye. So this is what we're seeing when we think about this. So this is the gravid female that burrows into the flesh, leaving this kind of uterine portion, and that's what you're presenting when you actually are able to extract it as fungiasis. So the life cycle is usually about a 2 to 4 millimeter flea, and then it eventually goes to 5 to 6 weeks. We get infestation with self-limited and not reinfected. Rare osteomyelitis can be associated as well as gangrene. We can see it in multiple different areas, and surgical removal of the fleas are very important. It's painful, like we said before. Sometimes curettage and excision is important. Topical ivermectin can be utilized as well as oral thiobendazole for very heavily infected patients. That's a bad syndrome. Myiasis, so infestation of human tissue by the fly larva. So as you can see, this is very like normal presentation for a patient. And they may have been just picking at it, you know, who knows what they're doing. But always thinking in the back of your mind, this could be something that's tropical dermatology related. So we have a painful boil that usually presents with myiasis. This lesion is more of a central punctum or respiratory pore to the exposed skin. It's this obnoxious infestation, both medically and aesthetically for patients. Neuromyiasis, you can see the one of those cycles that we had talked about that we've learned before and in the past, but the female basically glues their eggs to the mosquito, the stable fly or the tick that then therefore penetrates and makes these painful furuncles that soon develop in your patient. If you're going to do removal within these patients, an injection of local anesthetic is obviously very important because you're going to remove quite a big larva. As far as that, we have an outward bulging and then vascular occlusion of open furuncles, so you want to make sure that you're trying to really get this out completely. Otherwise, the larva will actually migrate forward. So older myiasis, this is where fly deposits eggs on the ground or clothing, and young maggots will actually penetrate the skin. We can see this is done by the African tuba fly, mango fly, and tsetse fly. And now another sunscreen issue. And just a couple more. Sequarial dermatitis or swimmer's itch, these are things that you guys are going to see. So we think about the distribution. It's transient pruritic, papular, or urticarial eruption for these patients on exposed skin as opposed to the bathing suit distribution. Typically, it's going to resolve in 7 to 10 days after freshwater snail exposure. So that's going to be your stromal larva, or it's going to penetrate the skin. But again, when I set out this kind of summary, I'll have a little bit more for you guys just to basically take into the clinic with you. Cutaneous anthrax. This is still present, and I know a while back we always talked about maybe it's in the mail or things like that, but when they present and you think about some of the single lesion that's on the finger, maybe usually there's something that's ulcerating, very necrotic, this is something you could think about. It's painless pruritic papules that become juicy. Overall, all about 48 hours they present with the bulla. The bulla ruptures early on in escar forms where we get this kind of raised border, so you can see there's their development from day 4 to day 10. Minimal scarring occurs, but that jet black ulcer is kind of what we always recognize for board exams as well. The lesions of cutaneous anthrax are evidently a predictable course, so we can kind of see from day 4 to day 10. After the toxin has been released in the skin, it becomes more necrotic, and by day 7, there's kind of a latency period. We get this manicule progressing to a non-tender, almost jet black eschar. Vesicles are the best place to find the first bacilli. One other thing to think about when you're thinking about fingers. So, a little shout out for veterinary people. My roommate growing in medical school was a vet, and she was saying that she presents a lot of the time with different cutaneous things that all of them were getting in their veterinary school, and no one really understood, but she said that multiple people, when they presented to the dermatologist, never asked them what they did. And she is out there hanging out with cows and sheep and all these different things, but they never asked like what was going on. So making sure that you really recognize what's going on with your patients, where are they from? I mean, it's easy when you're in farmland and everyone is working in farms, but you don't recognize that this person is a veterinary school or something where they're coming into contact with, just making sure you get a good clinical history. So this is ecthyma contagiosum. It's acquired from direct contact of lambs, calves, or goats. It has spontaneous resolution. There's usually a 1 week incubation period and resolves about 6 weeks. And just a couple more numbers. And that's it. I will be emailing you guys more about something you need to bring to the clinic that makes this a little bit more simplified. But any questions, I may email them to you, and then I'll send that out so you can always shoot me an email about questions or anything. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. watch you guys. If you want, you can be back at 11. I'm going to look for our next speaker a little bit before, and then I'll find you, okay? She should have a thumb drive, because I was in touch with her secretary, so we should be good. I'll start looking for her about 10, too.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you.
I'll be there.